Hello, and welcome back to season two of More Than Running with Dana. It's been a while since we left off together, and I'm so excited to come back to share some more stories of some phenomenal women. What I've realized over the past few months is that people matter. I originally wanted this season to have a theme, and I think the theme is just having genuine human connections and powerful conversations. The women featured on this season, again, will have very diverse perspectives on this world, with running be the core, centric thing that holds us all together. Everyone truly is more than running, and I'm here to share that and show that with you all. Thank you so much for following along, and I'm very excited for this season. I'm so excited today to have Michelle here. Welcome to the podcast, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
So Michelle, I've done a little bit of research, most research on you, stalked you all over the internet, but you truly seem to be a jack of all trades. Your bio on your website reads, "My roles vary from writer for print online, social media manager, broadcast commentator, vision mixer, live announcer, interviewer to communications consultant for meets, managers, athletes, and sporting federations." Wow, that is so much. That's from you. Those are your words. Is that the best way to sum it up?
I really struggle putting it together, and I do really struggle explaining to people what I do, especially people that don't work in the sport or that aren't in the industry, because it is truly very varied. And I think all those different roles help each other. And I think that over the years, I've learned new skills. I found that if I can improve one skill, that doesn't necessarily mean that I have to drop something else. By dipping different roles, you understand how media or sports media or the sport as a whole tends to work. And I think that's why I'm trying to learn as much as possible, not because I can't decide, but just because I think that it helps kind of understand the product better that we're trying to promote.
And you specifically, would you consider yourself freelance right now? I know you kind of call yourself a consultant, but you do most of your work for World Athletics, correct?
I do, yes. So I think my contract with them is about 240 days a year or something, so that covers a lot. But I am allowed to work with other outlets, I suppose, on things that I don't necessarily do with them. And so my role with World Athletics has evolved over the years. I started out working on one of their projects, which was Spikes magazine at the time when it was still print, and then moved online. To then doing more on their social channels, to now actually doing a lot more on the stakeholder side for them. So working really closely with athletes and member federations and helping them with their communications and understanding social, which means that when I do other work, whether that's with European athletics commentating or with the London Marathon, like doing announcing for them in the past on the course and stuff like that, that doesn't really interfere with one another. But actually, as I said, the roles complement each other.
So much to get into. I love all these hats. There's things that are very important to me as well. So I feel like we have a lot in common here. I really want to go back to the beginning, though. So where did this passion for athletics, and honestly, I love calling it that in America, you know, track and field is just very mouthy. I'm here for saying athletics, and I think that should be our first mission, is to convert that. But yeah, where did the love of the sport start for you?
Honestly, I think through my dad. I've grown up in a family that loves athletics. I know that not everyone can hear, but I'm German, so there's a lot of confusion over the accent. And we'll get to where that comes from. But my dad, when he was younger, used to be a decathlete. Kind of quit the sport for a bit and went traveling around the world, met my mom, lived in Africa for a while, which is where my sister and I grew up for the first few years of our life. And then when we returned, when I was about three, he kind of got back into athletics again, and we basically spent a lot of our weekends and time when we were little kids at the track. And we'd have, I don't know, family holidays around, like meets that he was doing. I mean, by that point, he was already masters and was kind of not competing at elite level.
Wow.
But at the time, yeah, we were very much, we were never forced into it. I started out doing gymnastics when I was little because you could only start athletics at my local club when you were six. So I started doing gymnastics and then turned six and then I was like, bye, gymnastics, I'm doing athletics now.
What was your main event? Did you try it all? Your dad was a multi-eventer, so he had experience in so many. Did something pull you in?
In Germany, pretty much everyone starts as a multi-eventer. And if you look at the history that we have,
Checks out.
So you kind of like get thrown in there and you have to do everything. And we're quite big on certain team competitions as well. So it's sometimes you have to do an event that might not be this one, but you do it anyway. So I started out doing that. And then when I got into my teens, I really struggled with all kinds of injuries. I think I was one of the unluckiest people there is. My sister was always, I mean, she had her fair share of injuries as well, but she was definitely better than me or more consistent. So I would end up following the sport a lot more through her than actually myself achieving great things on the track. And I think I knew that I wanted to stay in the sport, but I knew that it probably wasn't going to be through being an athlete. And I had loads of doctors saying, oh, you know, your body isn't quite made for this. Maybe you should start swimming. I hated swimming.
Yeah, me too.
So
it's so different.
I started coaching the kids in my local club, like the younger ones, just so I could stay involved. I was writing for the local club paper and through that stayed involved. But then it also coincided with finishing high school and actually figuring out what you want to do. Which I didn't know at the time. And so I ended up going on a gap year in London and became an au pair for a year, which has nothing to do with athletics. That's where the accent comes from. Exactly.
Okay. I was going to guess South African, but you never know. And there's a little of everything.
Do you know what? So many people guess South African. You really like that's the most common one. But yeah. So ended up going to London and then during that year figured out, well, there are great sports journalism courses in the UK that I couldn't find in Germany. And then from one gap year, it kind of turned into almost 8 years abroad and degree there and working in the industry for a bit.
That's amazing. And where are you currently located?
So I'm back in Germany now. I lived in the UK for nearly 8 years. So went over in 2010 as an au pair. Then from 2011 till 14, I was at university in the north of England. And then in my final year, I was kind of figuring out where I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. And I got offered the job on Spikes while I was still at uni. And they were super supportive and kind of just said, well, you go and do that job, just come back for exams and hand in your dissertation and whatever, and off I went.
Wow.
So, yeah, I know things don't often work like that. And I think I was very, very fortunate to be at the right place at the right time, having made the right contacts while I was at university.
Yeah, and it seems like you're probably not home very often.
That is correct. And I think that was one of the deciding factors why I moved back to Germany. So I think especially the last 2 years when I was in London, I was kind of looking at how much rent I was paying versus how little I was at home. And also then having issues like if you need someone in the house to, I don't know, you've ordered something or like you need someone to water your plant, that doesn't really work the same way in a big city, the way it would kind of work over here. Mm-hmm. And so when my tenancy was up, I decided to come back to Germany. I'm back near my parents now. I'm super close to Frankfurt Airport, which having
that is huge
nearby, exactly, is one of the key factors. And yeah, actually it's really nice to be a bit closer to home, that when you do have a bit of downtime between all the traveling, to actually allow yourself to really connect with old school friends who might have families now, and as I said, having my own family close as well.
So with this style of job, it seems like you have to be someone who enjoys the travel. What is your What are the things that you love and kind of hate about being on the circuit? Because 240 days a year, that's most of the time. I do want to switch into kind of what exactly you do, but let's just talk about Michelle on the road for a little bit.
I think the great thing, and I do think that being kind of still, dare I say, fairly young in the industry does help at the moment, because I think it allows you to take on more jobs than you would maybe if I was fully settled with kids and family and whatever. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that I think over the years, a lot of people that I get to work with, I count as friends now. So actually traveling the circuit, being at events, it's tough work and it's long hours, but you're around people that you actually get on really well. And that makes the jobs that you do a lot easier to cope with. I love when at championships, it's always a little trickier, but on the one day meet circuit, when you're kind of like arriving a day or two prior to the event, then you have like press conferences and stuff, then you have the meet day, and then the next day you're leaving again. So it's always kind of very short. But mm-hmm. over the last few years in particular, I've really tried to make an effort of going to see some of the places that we do get to visit, and that tends to work the best through running, which mm-hmm. is something that I have rediscovered, I think, since finishing uni and starting work in the industry again. It's picked up more or less, and I think I've become better with actually making time on the circuit to say half an hour in the morning or 45 minutes in the morning, actually going out and seeing something of the amazing places that we get to visit.
Well, it sounds like the distance runner in you is truly coming out. I don't know if your dad would be there here for that, but it truly is the best way to see the city. And I've experienced just one or two meets on the circuit, and you really, as an athlete, you don't get to see anything. You are the only time you really get to see is on the bus. Buses on the way there, and kind of if you get that half a day on the other end. So it is a very interesting life. I have a lot of listeners that probably don't exactly know what World Athletics does. Obviously, you guys last year went through a major rebrand. You were the IAAF, and now you're World Athletics. So can you just take high level through what a normal non-COVID year would look like?
So, as I said, my role has evolved over the last few years. It started out more on the content and social side of things. And over the last 2 years in particular, or now almost 3 years, for me, it's moved a lot more into the stakeholder side of things. And that came about because I started out doing more kind of interviews, writing, and so forth. And one of the things that being on the circuit around the athletes, I noticed was that a lot of them didn't actually understand how unique a lot of them were and how interesting some of their stories were. So you'd be sitting down at breakfast and somebody would tell you about the absolute horror story they had getting to a track meet, losing their poles along the way, and then having to chase them through a Paris airport or whatever. And then you'd be sitting in a press conference with that same athlete 2 hours later, and you'd kind of get the very standard, just so glad to be here, and just taking it round by round kind of answers. And that is a two-way street, because it's also dependent on the questions that you get asked. But I think if you as an athlete understand what it is that you want to communicate about yourself, about your interests, about the sport a little better, then it'll also help other people get to know you a little bit better. And I think one of the things that has been statistically proven time and time again is that people cannot remember numbers. And we're in a sport that lives off numbers. So
yes.
So how do you get people to connect with the athletes when they don't understand the performances that they're putting on the track or in the field? And so with athletes, storytelling things and actually understanding how they can communicate their own stories better, whether that is through other journalists or whether that is through their own social media channels or whatever avenues they want to explore, then that can only be good for the sport. And when I brought that to my boss at World Athletics, she completely agreed, and we worked out a way of how we can make this work. And so now a lot of my time that I am on the circuit, yes, I do still help out with creating content, but a lot of time is actually spent sitting down with athletes, most of the time one-on-one, working amazing. On their storytelling skills and actually understanding how to better use their channels. And that's not just we sit down once and then we're done, but let's take a look at where you're at and how can we gradually move it to where you want it to be. And also planning ahead for what's happening when your career isn't like it's finished on the track. Where do you see yourself in 10, 15 years time? And so that's one part. And then especially last year, we've started doing the same with member federations, because if they can help their athletes become better storytellers and then similarly can help their athletes tell better stories, then hopefully the sport will become more prominent in their nation or in their area. And so those are the two things that I've been mostly doing. And then when it comes to actual big events such as World Championships and the various World Athletic Series events that we have, then I tend to do more on the content side again.
Oh, I just got a huge chill, because that is something that I feel like I talk to my teammates about, and just the everyday run, it's how do we effectively tell people what we're doing? Because I run the mile, for example, and if I say any number under 5 minutes, people are like, wow, that's incredible. And you're like, well, no, technically I need to get this time. And then you lose your audience immediately. Yeah. So, and I find that the marathons are the best example of kind of placing yourself as a distance runner. How can you make the person who wins appealing to the person in the middle of the pack? And it's something where I've really noticed the past couple of years that certain people, I've never even seen them perform before, but are just very, very compelling. Do you have kind of some people that you love the content that they create, or people that you've seen progress through working with you? Kind of what are those nuggets that you look out for?
I think it's very hard, because a lot of times people start at very different levels. And I think a marathon there, that's actually an example that I often use with athletes, especially those that aren't necessarily that active on social. Mm-hmm. Because I think when you explain to them the differences in platforms and why it's important to be visible across different platforms, so you're not just on Instagram or not just on Facebook or Twitter, because of depending on like which audience you're trying to appeal to and where your main market lies and where you're from. And I think sometimes when you talk about these things, you can come across very scary if you're not particularly active, or if you mm-hmm. if you're not necessarily a big fan of social media. A lot of people tend to use social media, but more as a consumer rather than a contributor. And so it's about explaining to them the value that it has for them and why it's important, and why fans care and why the media uses social media as a research tool. And the thing that I always say is, well, you don't have to, from now that we're sitting down to next week, go up and increase the amount of posts that you produce by 300%. And you don't have to start vlogging, and you don't have to tweet every single day. But it's about gradually building on mm-hmm. where you're at now. And exactly like when I decide today I want to run a marathon, I'm not going to go out the next day and run a marathon, because it's not that easy. Mm-hmm. So it's about easing your way in and starting gradually and looking at, okay, actually, what do I feel comfortable sharing with other people? What do I want people to know about myself that is track related? What do I want to people to know about myself that is more personal? And which platforms are the best for that? So we're really looking at those things, and then also looking at your narrative overall and where you started out and what got you to this point where we're now sitting down together having a conversation, and where do you see yourself further down the line. So picking one or two people is really hard. Someone who's been really good and who's very active about also asking for kind of feedback is Noah Lyles. His management has been really good with also kind of setting up workshops for some of the people that they work with. And he's always someone when he sees something, like, I don't know, when before Instagram introduced what do you call it, like breaks, and people would be putting dots, and he saw people doing it and he was like, how do you do it, Michelle? So he's not afraid to ask. And I think that's something that I wish more people would do, because you often see how something works or see what people do and you don't know how it works. And I think that's something that, he's fantastic. He's really kind of understood the power that his voice has. And there's a lot of athletes out there that are great by themselves. I think they're
I wonder if that's an age thing too, of someone who, Elias is obviously a younger athlete, someone who grew up with it. One thing I've noticed a lot, and as an athlete, I find is a little frustrating, is kind of these fitness influencers are so good at what they do and have the time and resources to do so. But as an athlete, that's almost exactly who you're competing against. But you're like, well, I'm an athlete. I have to focus on my athletics and the training and my time that I'm doing it. I can never create in that same way. But from an outsider, that is truly who you're competing against. But I sometimes feel like as athletes, we just think we're, you know, telling our story against other track athletes. But in reality, it's the bigger space.
And that's exactly one of the reasons also why we started doing this, because we said, well, we're seeing now athletes are competing against influencers and the likes for sponsorship, not just from like, I don't know, like the more lifestyle brands, but really also shoe companies and so forth. And I think getting athletes to understand that, sadly, even if you don't necessarily like it, it's part of the job now. And even if it's 15 minutes a day, making time for it, that it is just part of the job and how to, and it's just about giving people the tools to be able to do it. I think, and I'm definitely not saying anybody should become a vlogger and should dedicate a lot of time for that. But it's also about coaches understanding the importance of that. Maybe every few days at the track, you're allowed to take your phone out of your bag, which not everyone
likes. That definitely is a thing.
So I think it's about really trying to find a way to make it work for everyone to an extent where they feel comfortable. I don't think anyone should feel that they have to do something or that they have to post X amount of times a day or that they have to post that many pictures a week or whatever. But it's about understanding that actually it might also help inspire someone, because at the same time that you're trying to promote yourself, you're also promoting the sport. And I think that's something that is very important for maybe young kids out there that don't really know what it's like being an athlete on the circuit or how someone got to where they are. And I think that the more transparent you can be with these things, the more relatable and more authentic you become.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Big question I have for you is, what are your kind of your long-term, I guess, medium and long-term goals? I'm going to call it media broadcasting as more of a general term. I'm sure that's not the correct term, but more of, where do you see Michelle's world expanding to?
It's a very good question.
I know, it's a big one.
I think at the moment, I think, as I said, I quite like the fact that I get to do a lot of different things. And I think I love seeing people do well that have gone through, I don't want to call it training because it sounds really formal, but that I've worked with and seeing when our sport gets picked up or gets more coverage, or when stories that we've heard about internally first or that an athlete might have said initially, I don't know whether I feel comfortable talking about this, and then once you've kind of like talked through an idea, they feel comfortable talking about it and it actually gets the conversation about a certain topic going. So for me, that's definitely something that I want to stay involved in and want to keep doing, because I think it can only be a good thing for the sport. Similarly, the same goes with member federations. The more we can do to equip them to become better advocates for the sport in their kind of ecosystem, the better it is for the sport globally, because the more people care about the sport in each nation, the more people care about the sport around this world. I do really enjoy the broadcast side of things. I have to say I've not done that much yet. I'm actually like still very inexperienced if you look at it from that perspective. I think like the three kind of major things that I've done commentary on were European athletics events, so it was the European championships in Berlin, and then two European team championships, and last year over the course of the season World Athletics launched a new concept which we called World Athletics Club, and it was kind of like a chat show, and it was always kind of previewing World Athletics Series events, and it grew pretty quickly from, okay, we're doing this recorded sit-down chat with a bunch of athletes and show some features, to, okay, we have 10 live-produced shows in stadium, in Doha, in front of the people in the stadium and going out live, and
wow,
which was very daunting. But I do think that with all of this, it's because people actually give you or have given me an opportunity to do it and have had the faith in me being able to do it. And I think that's something that I definitely like to do more of, but obviously need someone to have the faith in you and say, actually, yeah, I think you'd be a great fit for this. Mm-hmm. But that often is, I think, an issue in the industry with giving new people an opportunity. It's a bit the chicken and the egg debate. Yeah. Of, well, we want more women in the sport or in sports broadcasting or in the sports media, mm-hmm. But they need to be given the platform. And I've watched my first commentary gig back just because I know that's the only way that you can get better and actually listen to yourself.
Oh, it's so hard to re-listen.
It's one of the hardest things there is. And I think the only way that you can get better is if you get to do it again. And if you like listen to yourself, you see where you have to improve and then get feedback from other people as well, rather than just kind of get people telling you, oh, that was terrible. So it's definitely something that I'd like to do more of, but I wouldn't compromise it for the other work that I do, because I genuinely feel that that is what drives the sport forward in helping the people in our sport become better storytellers.
I do love that one thing you noted on your website was you were the first female at the London Marathon to announce to London Marathon is one of the largest in the world. You were at the finish line. I've actually done that, not at the Boston Marathon yet. That was anticipated this year, but the BA Half Marathon and 10K. And I have to say, that is an endurance sport in and of itself, finishing announcing a marathon. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience at London?
Yeah, so London was, it was super strange because I ran London in 2016. God knows how that happened, but that was a whole experience in itself. And then 2017, I started doing commentary for European Athletics. And then 2018, I wanted to run London again. And I got injured, I think it was in February that year. And the doctor was like, yeah, there's absolutely no way you'll be ready to run a marathon in April. And I was like, oh, no. And then I moved, that was the year that I moved back to Germany. And it kind of everything was a bit, I'm losing London. And then the guys from the London Marathon actually came to me and said, well, you know a lot of the athletes, a lot of the background stories, and actually it'd be quite nice to have a bit of color on the finish line. And so they asked whether I'd want to join the likes of Jeff Whiteman and Chris Temple at the finish line doing the announcing with them. And as you said, it's a marathon sport in itself because you start super early. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have like all the kind of kids races there as well, the wheelchair races coming through and the elites and then the mass races, and it just keeps going and going. And then you kind of mm-hmm. take turns in who does the announcing at the top and then running down and getting some of the finishers for interviews and stuff. And as we were kind of preparing to do all of it, I think it might have been that somebody from the production actually came up and said, you're actually the first woman we have doing this. And I was shocked because I mean, it was 2018 and there are tons of amazing women announcers wow. and commentators, and I mean a lot of them have done the broadcast coverage, but the actual like by the finish line, apparently they hadn't had a woman do it. And I thought, actually, I don't think I'm worthy. I think like it would have been a lot more fitting.
No.
I don't know, a Paula or someone would have done that. And yeah, I think that was, to me, that was something really, really special, and I really enjoyed doing that just because I was there with people that were super experienced, that had done a lot of times, and it was just a really fun experience, not just the elite side of things but mm-hmm. also the master race side of things, because having run that marathon and having experienced how tough it is but also how amazing the support from the crowd is, it just felt really special to be able to do that in a year when I had planned on running and I couldn't.
That's incredible. One thing I do hear as a woman in the space is that sometimes the female voice is quote unquote unappealing. It's not as deep. It's not as booming for announcing. And I genuinely hope that stigma is going away. And obviously each federation and each country has their own commentating as well, but doing it at a major event like that, that's pretty incredible.
Definitely. And I think, I mean, we've definitely seen on the broadcast side, great women coming through. I mean, Shalane's done an amazing job on this day last year at Ineos doing the commentary. And we've got, I think, at this year's London Marathon, I was watching the BBC coverage, and you had Hannah England doing an amazing job on one side, and then Mari Yamauchi doing an amazing job on the international feed.
Yeah, we had Dina Caster and Amy Hastings on the US feed.
So I think that's like seeing this development's really, really good. And it just makes me really excited. And I do think that more and more people realize that having not only a different sounding voice, but also a different perspective is something that is quite like makes something that can be like dragging out a bit like a marathon a lot more interesting. The one thing that I do think that I wish it would change a little is all these women that we've just mentioned, they're all athletes, former or still current athletes. And I do think that unless, or I don't know whether that's how to describe it, but I think unless you're someone that already has a foot in the door in the sport, it becomes a lot harder to work in that industry. And I mean, I look at university courses and what I want to do and saying I want to study sports journalism. And I had family members who do work in sports saying, not my parents, by the way, but people like close saying, don't you think that's a bit too niche, or don't you think that there aren't going to be many opportunities in sport, or it will be really tough to find a job in that industry. And I wonder to an extent of whether that same advice would be given to a guy who's trying to find a job in that industry. And I was the only girl out of 50 on my course at university. Women or no girls in the year above. I think there were two in the year below. I was helping out at open days at the university where you'd have girls come in and look at the course, and they would see that there's basically no one else who looks like them, who sounds like them, who thinks like them. And then they'll think, oh, I'm just going to go for the just journalism or music journalism or journalism and popular culture course, because at least I won't be the only girl and I can then always try and try that. But I think that more and more will ultimately help get more women in. And as I said, I hope, yes, it's amazing to get athletes in there who have just a really unique view of the sport and that can give an insight that someone like myself can never give. But at the same time, not discouraging someone who might not have been a world-class athlete to try and give this career a shot, because it's an amazing career and you meet amazing people from all over the world. And I really hope that more women will come through.
That really hit me as well. You know, I was very nervous to even start this podcast because, you know, if you don't even want a national title or a U.S. title, it's almost as if you sometimes feel like you don't have an opportunity to have your voice. And it truly has only been, you know, in talking to have reached out to me to be like, well, he has an opportunity and a voice to be able to share. And you don't have to be the number one athlete who has done it themselves. You can carve your own path. So I think it's really incredible what you're doing. You probably have one of the most international jobs in the world. I don't even know how many member federations are, but let's talk a little about how you communicate with athletes who, you know, don't speak English or from different areas. How do you create that in-person relationship with an athlete?
That's a really good question. And it's definitely something that I have to work on more in order to like actually address it. I mean, I'm lucky that I obviously speak German and English, and my French isn't completely terrible. Very lucky that I have one of my colleagues at World Athletics, for example, Laura, is one of the most language-wise talented persons there is, and she speaks about, we always joke about, 87 languages simultaneously translating and so forth. She is definitely someone that when it comes to especially French or Spanish, Italian, that can help out on that side as well. So especially when we're doing workshops for like, as you said, member federations in areas like whether they're Spanish speaking and so forth, that's definitely where she would also be stepping in. So we do work closely with that. Same with French-speaking workshops. As a federation, we mostly communicate or internally communicate English. With athletes, it's often relying on managers to help translate when you do sit down. Luckily, I think, especially because at the moment, a lot of the sessions that I do are on the circuit, and a lot of those people, like on the Diamond League Continental Tour level circuit, those athletes tend to speak English. So most of them we can do in English, and then it comes to relying on help and translation from those guys, from those guys' management. But I definitely think that I can do more. I wish I spoke Spanish. That's the one thing but I mean there's only so many languages you can learn.
I think it's the polyglot. Is that the word for knowing all multiple languages? It's very impressive. We are very language stunted here in America, so respect to anyone who knows more than I do. I really want to highlight as we close this up is your experience in Doha, and then today being the day it is, the year anniversary of the INEOS 159, so the world has completely changed in a year. Can you speak to this time last year for you? It seemed like it was a highlight of production and Doha, everything that World Athletics created, being so far away from the rest of the world, but truly bringing World Athletics together to INEOS. And then after that, we'll talk about COVID and how this year has changed.
I think Doha is a massive talk for everyone involved. I think I was, like you said at the start, I was doing several roles there. So we had this World Athletics Club, which was for the first time, we said, okay, we're producing it live in stadium. We were working with the event presentation team. So it was like a real kind of cross-department gig that we were working on. And it was about how can we bring more live content to the audience? How do we get people excited about the upcoming sessions? How do we bring in more personality? So we always had guests in, whether that was retired athletes that were there in different capacities, or whether that was winners from the day before and getting them to kind of relive their experience in the stadium and stuff. So that was a super cool experience. So that kind of took up most of the day, from like morning planning out the session or like what was coming ahead to actually going live. And then once that happened, I would run up, get changed into my just usual kind of team polo shirt again, head to the media tribune, and then would take over a lot of the social channels and like making sure we have all of our graphics and the memes. And
you guys are great at memes.
we did step it up in Doha, that's true. And I'm glad that the organization understood actually the value that a bit more of a lighthearted approach brought to the overall social strategy, and kind of looking at, okay, we've got X amount of highlights that we can use. How do we clip these up? When can they be published and so forth? So, and then that really runs into the middle of the night. And by the time the session finishes at, I don't know, midnight or just after midnight, you kind of then finish up writing everything and scheduling a few things over the night because you're in a different time zone to the US market or the Australian or Oceania or Asian market, and then kind of make it back to the hotel by about, I don't know, half three, and then you go to sleep and get up early for the next morning briefing, and then it kind of goes like this for 10 days.
That is exhausting. I can't even imagine how you were standing by the end of that. But so you finished your 10 days in Doha. Can you tell us, huge success, it seemed like, from the World Athletics side?
Definitely. I think it was, there was a lot of doubt over how it would be perceived. And I know there was comments about crowds and everything, but actually I think especially from about day three or four, the tone really changed. And I do think that ultimately, I think it was a massive task, but I think they really managed to pull it off in terms of like the atmosphere was great. Obviously, the likes of Mutas Barshim doing well really helped. As you said, the social was really well received. I think we were a lot more daring with, as I said, the memes and the content that we were putting out. We had a bigger team, which also made a big difference. And I think, you kind of like the last day, I always find the day after championships, it always feels like, I don't know, all the adrenaline starts to wear off and you're finding yourself at the airport and everyone seems to be leaving at the same time and you're kind of like queuing and you see, oh, there's this person I know and there's this person. And then it was so late in the season as well that you knew you weren't going to see each other to the end of season. Normally it's kind of like Worlds is in August and then you see each other in like Brussels or in Zurich for a Diamond League final. And this time around it was like, really, this is the end of the season. So it was quite an, I think, emotional day, the day afterwards as well. And you kind of, as you said, overworked and just watching so many amazing performances and seeing so many people that you have kind of seen over the years grow up. Like there was a lot of young winners that we saw that had really risen through the ranks from like, I don't know, Cali in 2015 over World Under 20s and Butkosh and World Under 18s in Nairobi and God knows which other events. And suddenly seeing those people really fulfill their dreams. I don't know, Nicholas Cowell's a prime example for that for me, is again being German.
Yeah.
Really risen through the ranks and we've watched become world champ, like the youngest decathlon world champion there is, which just it makes this job even better because you really feel that you in a way have watched these people grow up.
That's amazing. And then you, but after that you went directly to Ineos, correct? Last year?
I had one night at home.
Home. You went all the way home.
Yeah. I mean, it made sense. Going from Doha to Frankfurt, Vienna, then it's easy enough. So I managed to drop off all my dirty laundry and then pack a new bag and, yeah, headed to Ineos. I think I went back on the Monday and went to Vienna on the Wednesday. And that was, again, it was a pretty last minute thing. The London Marathon guys were also doing a lot of the kind of planning around it. So they really helped with the course and did a lot of the media operations and stuff. And so they were the ones that kind of came to me and said, oh, we've noticed that actually Vienna or Austria is a German speaking country. And while, yes, we have German announcers on site, we also need someone that is English speaking because there'll be a big international audience. And again, you having worked with Elliot and the likes before, at least they'll know you. So do you fancy coming to do this? So yeah, I got to go, did the kind of hosted the press conferences that were held beforehand and the one afterwards. And then on the day, again, got to do the finish line announcing and the interviewing. And it was just from an organizational perspective, I've never seen anything that was so like strictly planned out and everyone knew what everyone was doing at what time. And it was, I guess, it was such a unique event because every single person involved in the event was working towards one goal, which was
it's very unique.
Exactly, because in our sport normally it's you have a whole bunch of people and everybody's kind of rooting for someone else. And I think that's what makes our sport great, because it's unpredictable and that's like everybody's rooting for a different personality. But with an event like this, it was just everyone working on this wants this one outcome.
Sub-2-hour marathon.
Exactly. So that's why it was just super fun just to almost be like a spectator from one side of things, because I hadn't been involved in any of the lead up stuff. Like you've been following it and you know some of the people that are involved and you talk to them about it and you do your research, but you actually see it and having like the daily meetings and really seeing how much effort had gone into it and really to like the smallest detail everything was planned out was just really amazing to see. And then obviously him running sub-2 was just amazing.
What is your Iliad highlight of I've heard he's very almost monk-like and poetic, and you know, what was it like being so close to the experience?
I mean, I couldn't believe I was doing the like a post-race interview with him. First he did the live stream and like with Gabby Logan and those guys, and then he came to me and he did the interview kind of for the people that had, like, I mean, it was 120,000 people that lined this course, which is amazing for 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning. But wow. For me, it was just amazing how, like, as you said, like the way that he talks, he just run a sub-2-hour marathon and you ask him a question and he comes out with the kind of calmest, most sensible answer there could be. And it was just, you're kind of just in awe at the person that he is. And I could listen to him all day. My other favorite thing about this whole day was that his family was there for the first time for one of his races. And we had his wife briefly talked to us during the race and said what it meant to her. And then his little daughter also kind of had a little segment. Aww. And I got to interview her. Lynn, her name was. And it was the first time that she'd been at one of her dad's great, like, big races. And she was super shy at first. And then I asked her whether he was going to break two. And she said, yes, of course. And the crowd just, like, went wild. Aww. And then I said, can you give us a big go, dad? And she just, like, did this really big go, dad. And from, like, this person that was just hiding a second ago and, like, talking really quietly to just burst out this big cheer. And then, like, the crowd erupted and she kind of, like, ran off. And it was just so, so powerful to see how much it meant to them as well to get to see their dad make history.
Oh, you mentioned the word crowds, something we have not seen in a very long time. What has this year been like for you? So indoor season, let's fast forward to March. Your job involves a ton of travel, being at the meets. Your team has had to, I take it, massively pivot to be able to cover, and then last minute be able to cover these events virtually. How has this all been working for you?
It was a big challenge. I think, the indoor season went fairly normal, except for the fact that obviously from March on, everything was cancelled. So World Indoors was cancelled. We had a whole bunch of stuff obviously planned in terms of gathering content early on in the year as well, going into an Olympic year. That all went out the window. And we kind of had to stick our heads together and come up with like solutions of, okay, how do we keep people entertained? How do we keep people motivated? I think it was quite a scary time for a lot of people as well, because no one really knew what was going on. And so from a comms strategy perspective, we launched a whole new series called Athletics at Home when lockdown started. And a lot of it was based around experiences that we were seeing in our close environment. So people suddenly having to work from home, kids not going to school, you literally being in lockdown. So we created a whole bunch of educational materials for kids, whether that was coloring in or athletics exercises, or like exercise at home with elite athletes, getting them on the screen and all those things. And then obviously as things started to progress, we then also did the whole Ultimate Garden Clash series.
Oh, which... I love those. The pole vault competitions.
Yes. So it came of the mind of Renaud Lavillenie, who's the chair of our athletes commission. And I do a bit of work with them. And he called me one day and he said, Michelle, I need your help. I've got a pole vault pit in my garden. Sam's got one and Mondo's got one. We want to have a competition. Can this be shown simultaneously from three locations? And I said, well, I don't know, but let's see whether we can figure it out. And so we did a whole bunch of testing. And I mean, the first one, we had no idea what we were getting into. And it was, I can't tell you how many days and weeks it took us to get it all figured out, and how I think by the end of it, Sam, Mondo and Renaud were probably tired of me chasing them for upload speed and download speed, and send me please this teaser that I need from you, and I need more information from you there, and we need to do more rehearsals there. And the poor guys in the US had to always get up early, and the likes of Mondo really didn't like that. So it was, I mean, it was a big job. But then seeing how it was received, and that it was literally the first kind of world-class sport out there during that time, and the fact, I mean, it was on the BBC news, it was on French television in the news, it was on the German news, like it was everywhere. We then kind of went, okay, right, this went well. And the next day got a text from Kat Stefanidi, who said, well, the women need to do it now. And
of course
yeah.
And now things are feeling a little bit more put together. You know, there's been some races over in Europe. The U.S. athletes somehow got in through Monaco, so we're able to join the party. Have you been able to attend any of the meets so far, or is it very limited as far as the media?
No, so because, again, we, through World Athletics, and because a lot of them kind of are, I don't want to say our meets because I'm not organizing them, but they fall like very much under the World Athletics umbrella. It was very important for us that the ones that we could attend, we would attend. Mm-hmm. And so when actually it started out with the Continental Tour in Turku on August 11th, I think it was, and then it was followed by Monaco, and then we had Székesfehérvár in Hungary and Stockholm. So we definitely did see throughout August and September the events starting up again. And yeah, as I said, it was quite important for us that even though we had to really respect strict guidelines, we really wanted to be on site. And so I ended up going to, and also it was a lot more us working closer together with the meets and with the mm-hmm. Diamond League on resource sharing. So how can we, again, it's good if you're a jack of all trades in these situations, yes. Because okay, if we're only sending one writer and someone for social, can that person maybe also film? Okay, is that person like a little tech savvy, or do they have a camera and can get some content in if somebody else from maybe a country that currently has travel restrictions can't go and so forth? So I ended up, I think I went to Monaco, Hungary, Stockholm, Brussels, and the ISTAF in Berlin. So it ended up being a lot more than good. I had hoped. Gone through the whole COVID testing and wearing masks. I've literally just done another one today because we're off to Gdynia for the World Half Marathon Championships later this week. So I think that's COVID test number 8 now.
Safety first.
Exactly. No, and I do think that having been on the circuit, the one thing that really came across strongly this year was that people were just really appreciative of the fact that they got to compete, and everyone was really respectful of the rules. Everyone really, like, really, really appreciated being there, no matter mm-hmm. the meet. It was just being nice to see each other. Like, a lot of people hadn't seen each other since Doha last year because some didn't do an indoor season, and then there was no outdoors for ages. And so it was really kind of a slight, like a tiny bit of normalcy, and people were a lot more willing to help each other out, and there was flight cancellations and poles getting lost, and I mean that happens in the regular season as well, but I think it was
just to be a pole vaulter.
I think it was just really nice to see people really pulling together and trying to help each other out, and giving each other tips and saying, hey, I know you can get a test there, and I know that like those guys are good with like travel and so forth. So yeah,
to see like on the field the athletes in their individual spots. I don't know if that was at every meet, but a couple, they had their own zones. Yeah. That was bizarre.
It was I think the first one where I like consciously noticed it was obviously Monaco, where they didn't have any throws because they completely turned the infield into call room and mixed zone to an extent, and like we weren't allowed in the mixed zone to cross. And in the mixed zone we had and we've organized this at most meets this year, and Matt from the Diamond League's done an amazing job with this and actually coming up with a virtual mixed zone concept whereby journalists who can't be in the mixed zone because of either social distancing or because they can't even go to the event can send in questions and request an athlete, and then there is someone dedicated who has tested negative that is asking the questions to the athlete, and then the journalists get those answers from the athlete via video. And so yeah, we're like on one side of the field, and then on the other side is the track, is the call room, and they're all spread out. And it was the same with the field events where I don't know, the pole vault beds had to be like desanitized afterwards, and it was wild.
So I have three rapid fire questions I did send earlier. So maybe this way we won't offend so many athletes because I know you're friends with everyone. And then I have one final big question for you, but here they are, rapid fire. Favorite track event and why?
I don't know whether I'm like, that's a cop out, but it's the Maltese, I think.
And no, you can cop out of this one. If we go into too many explanation, that's where the feelings get hurt.
No, I think the multi-events, just because they're so versatile and the guys are just like blowing my mind and how they can do what they do.
All right. Current favorite athletes to watch compete when that person isn't on the field or on the track, you can't look away.
I love Yuli Marojas. I think she's the way that she just expresses herself is incredible. Similarly, the likes of Carsten Barholm, like anyone that really kind of puts emotion into it. But yeah, I don't want to offend anyone, but those are two definitely.
You know, once this podcast has big enough reach to offend, then I will know I've made it. And the next one is, what world record will fall next?
Do you know, I really had to think about that one. Don't want to jinx it saying it's going to happen at the World Half. So I'm not going to say that, but I definitely think, I mean, the four hurdles everyone's talked about this year.
That's so. What I was going to go with too. If that doesn't happen soon.
I mean, he did say that he's thinking about running an 800 soon, which honestly, he's probably got to kill that as well. So. Yeah, and I'd love to see, I mean, we in Doha last year, I found the event was almost anticlimactic because it was like it'd been hyped up so much during the season, and Sambo then got injured halfway through the season and they only made it back for world champs and stuff. And I think next year, if the top three guys with Carsten and Rai and Samba will stay healthy, I think it could be absolutely amazing. So fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. And last question that I want you to leave everyone with is one thing we spoke about right before I clicked record was women supporting women. You are a very strong female voice within the field, creating new pathways, breaking down those walls. How do you see yourself creating opportunities for other women to follow in your footsteps or grow the space for other women?
I mean, I've been someone who's been incredibly lucky in that I've had strong women supporting me, and I don't think I'd be where I am today if it wouldn't have been for those women. So that's why I think it's such an important thing that we have to help each other out. As I think, as you said, we were talking about before we started recording this, I think there's this whole old boys club that's been supporting each other in any kind of industry or any walk of life, and that's just been totally accepted for years and decades. And I think women have been kind of lagging behind with that, because I don't know whether they felt that that wasn't the right thing to do, that maybe you shouldn't give someone a helping hand because they should earn it themselves, or also because so many women had it so hard to get to where they are that they felt that someone else needs to go through the same steps. But I do genuinely think that over the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, that's really shifted. And when I was at university, I was really lucky to be introduced to a group called Women in Football, that were journalists and agents and managers. And it was a network of women that was there to support women in the industry. And being the only woman on my course, it was really important for me to actually have someone to look up to that looked and talked and thought like me. And one of the women that was on the board for Women in Football was Vicky Orvice, who was an athletics writer with a son, and she sadly passed away from cancer last year. But she's always been someone that's just been so supportive, and that's always when she sees you somewhere at an event, she'll introduce you to someone, or when you need a contact for, I don't know, dissertation or whatever, she'd be supporting you with that. And I think that's something that we need to do more of. And that's something that I've always tried to do, is help people through contact. So if somebody says, hey, I'm looking for someone that I can talk to you about this, or I'm interested in the following subject, actually thinking about, actually, yeah, I know someone that can help with this, or that it hasn't, like, is an expert in this, because I still don't think that I'm enough of an expert in a lot of topics, but I know a lot of experts. And so if I can be someone that can help make connections, that is already a massive winner for me, because that's something that's helped me, is making connections and getting to know people and getting people to support me that way. And so that's definitely one thing. Obviously, anything that, like, if people have specific questions and like the areas that I do know more about, whether that is around social or whether that is mm-hmm. about kind of growing audiences and stuff, then I always try and make time for this. I've recently had a couple of students from different countries reach out to me and ask for help, and I try and answer that those questions honestly as possible. But like I said, I think I'm still not quite comfortable in the role of actually being asked for advice, because I've got so many things that I want to ask others and that I feel that I need to learn. But I definitely think that, like, having women in the industry and like having conversations with those women and sharing experiences is, and like conversations like the one we're having right now, it's just something that is just super, super powerful. And I hope that regardless of exactly the industry, whether that is media or whether that is more on the Federation side or the kind of organizational side of things, we do see more and more women coming through. And at least from my direct environment, I feel that that is definitely the case.
I love every part of that. This has been so amazing, Michelle. Where can people find you and follow your journey from the inside of World Athletics?
You can find me on the usual social media platforms. I think like Twitter and Instagram are probably the best ones, at Michelle Samet with 2 M-E-T. But yeah, no, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed this.
And that wraps up another episode of More Than Running with Dana. Hope you join us next week where we share another phenomenal woman's story about how she is more than running. Leave us a review on iTunes or Spotify. It really helps the podcast grow. If you ever have any suggestions of who we should have on the pod, feel free to drop me a message. Until next time. I only want a few close friends. The rest just pretend. I turn to people kissing in the stairwell. I want this day to end. Text my mama so I don't lose hope. I didn't learn anything I didn't know. Always yelling, get off your phone. Screw that, I'm going home. But did you hand that in? Nah, I'ma take a zero. Just call me.